Climate, Energy, and Resources and Trade Committees will now come to order. We have a quorum not only to do business, but of the entire legislature. And so we're going to do a lot here today. There's a secret agenda inside. Without further ado, I'd like to welcome our Senate members, Senator Stedman, Stevens, Huggins, Wagner, French, and myself, McGuire, and then turn it over to our co-chairman here in Representative Johnson to introduce his members.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Present today, Representative Tuck, Dugan, Gutenberg, Seaton, Edgman, co-chair of Resources, Newman, and Representative Johnson, co-chair.
One more, Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry, and Representative Wilson, I'm sorry, you snuck in on me. Thank you.
Okay, well, welcome. We're excited today. We've been joined by Porter Bennett, who flew in to visit with us. He is the founder and president of Bentech Energy, founded in 1985. Bentech is a leading analytics firm specializing in the U.S. natural gas market. And I'm going to call him up after we hear from, first, Dr. Mark Myers, who's our own in-house natural gas expert appointed by the governor. We're going to have him come forward and make a presentation, and then we're going to have Porter Bennett come up, and then questions from the committee. So, Mr. Myers. Dr. Myers.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chairman. And this will be sort of a repeat of the presentation I made last week, but I've added on some additional information on cost structure of Alaska gas and shale gas, and I've included a lot of data recently released by the EIA on their 2009 forecasts, and I'll highlight what the experts in the government agencies are saying in terms of how they predict shale gas and Alaska gas and LNG and all that mix to be needed and used in the United States and those trends. And I think there's a lot of good information that will look a little different than the previous assessments. So with that, I'll slideshow thing right here. One of these things. Let's click on this thing.
And Mark, just on the record, we are on an abbreviated time schedule today, so we have until 4:30 before our Senate finance guys need to leave.
Okay. So I'll go very quickly through these slides. As I said the last time, it's really important for you to see the data in context. So I start with this first slide that shows the world at night. It's a NASA composite photo, but it shows the amount of energy the world uses today. It's very different than the amount of energy the world even used a decade or two decades ago. It's entirely different than the amount of energy we used 100 years ago. And it will be entirely different 40 or 50 years from now. Well, the why, the biggest reason is population growth. We're at worldwide 6.5 billion people today. By mid-century, we'll be at 9 billion people. So more people, more demand, industrialization throughout much of the developing world, incredible increases in the amount of energy used. And given the limitations on resources, some of the traditional energy resources will have to be replaced with alternatives like natural gas. So we're seeing a dynamic change in worldwide markets as we speak. That change is requiring additional supplies of energy. Renewables will clearly play a role, but we cannot develop renewables fast enough to meet the growing world demand. Therefore, you're seeing changes in the natural gas market worldwide, in the oil market worldwide, in a big push for nuclear energy in much of the world, developing world, with the social, military, and national security implications of that. So we live in a very different world, in a changing world, and that changing world is using more and more and more energy. And it's a dynamic of population and industrialization and urbanization of our planet. And that little picture of the evolution and sort of de-evolution of humanity just shows that. We use energy differently. We use it in greater quantities. We live in air-conditioned houses. We use more water. We use more intensive energy with agricultural use, et cetera. So fundamentally, the world energy picture is one of growth. Historically, we have not been supply limited on energy. But we are coming to the point where we are becoming supply limited on traditional sources of energy, and you're starting to see shortages over time. Now, in that pattern, it's important to look for a project like Alaska, not the next two or three years, you know, as Mr. Mulva and others have said, but to look out 20 years, 30 years, because that's the time frame of the maximum delivery of our gas, 10 years to 30 years to 40 years. In that time frame, the short aberrations of localized recessions, of changes in short supply demand curves, in even in nationalization of oil supplies or gas supplies, play a big role. But in the long term, the demand drive is immense and intensive. And even in our country, as we've gotten over 300 million people, the growth is massive. So put it in context, there's the world growth by different supplies. Historically, we have made up a lot of that difference by increasing oil production to a point where oil production has been stretched, particularly when we're not in a recession. You also see a dramatic increase in coal, a subtle increase in nuclear, and worldwide an increase of use of natural gas. If you look again at what the energy mix is, one of the concerns we have for our project is there might be energy switching away to other sources. We hear about renewables, we hear about alternative sources of gas elsewhere, and this slide is to show you that over time, in spite of the local noise that's in there by two or three year cycles, that the overall demand growth increases and increases at a relatively steady rate. This pie shows that dominantly, presently, and in the future, fossil fuels will be our dominant energy source because we cannot grow renewables at a fast enough rate to offset the need and demand growth. So the pie gets bigger, as you can see in this picture, but the supply mix doesn't change dramatically. That said, that's the overall mix. The amount and the type of energy used for electricity does change. This is a 30-year slice, 1974 to 2004, and what you see there, in the United States, we stopped using much oil to generate electricity. You can see the big shift there. Natural gas, percentage-wise, increased only slightly because of supply limitations of gas. Total amount increased, but we weren't able to increase to totally offset that petroleum. Nuclear increased. Hydro shrunk to half, not because we decreased hydro capacity very much, but because we had maxed it out in the lower 48. So you can see the big growth has been in coal, and the big growth has been in this period of time nuclear, but we are no longer building those nuclear plants. So as you go in the future, we're going to have to find massive supplies of new energy for this country. And as I'll talk about later, in an environment where we are going to be constrained in our greenhouse gases, that amount of energy supply will have to come from sources that emit less CO2 than coal traditionally does, which again pushes you toward a gas economy. It also argues, because the rest of the world's facing similar type issues, that there's going to be real competition for overseas LNG to other markets, and we're already seeing that. LNG markets have switched dramatically, and I'll show you the EIA's projections of that here in a little bit. The other part of the equation, and I saw this in spades when I was director of the USGS, and we doing these national assessments on all sorts of resources, biological, water, all sorts of energy, nuclear, natural gas, coal, uranium. We basically did everything but wind energy, geothermal, in terms of assessments. And in that, you see that much of the demand growth that could be theoretically met is going to be limited because there are environmental consequences of the use of that energy. Renewable or not, wind farms use an inordinate amount of land space, require a new electrical grid, solar energy the same way, and you need a tremendous mineral base to develop battery technology. Each one of those resources all the way through has environmental consequences and risks, particularly those that use water, fresh water, in abundance. We are seeing the water supplies in this country stretched. Ethanol is a great example of one that's drawing down our aquifers at an alarming rate. This is the High Plains aquifer on the right. The red and dark areas are areas that are being drawn down. They're also being drawn down in the areas where basically agriculture, irrigation of agriculture of corn is causing non-sustainable use of water. That can't go on forever. There are going to be limits to growth of resources. Oil shales have challenges with water issues. Certainly growth of hydro does. And in some ways, shale gas will be limited by water issues locally, because shale gas takes a fair amount of water, 800,000 gallons to 4 million gallons per frack, depending on a vertical or horizontal well, and up to 10 fracks per well to sustain the life of that well. Now, that sounds like a lot of water, but in a lot of wells in areas like the arid west, that is going to be a challenge. It's been a challenge with coal bed methane, dewatering of wells. So certainly we're going to see growth of resources, but recognize there are land use constraints and environmental constraints that limit these growths. We see a lot of growth now, but you can't assume that same level of growth is going to continue in these resources because of these environmental or land use or resource limitations on many of these resources. So one of the things, again, is to address some of the issues that are occurring now that might, in the long term, may or may not affect our pipeline. So we certainly have seen a massive global recession that has led to a decrease in the use of energy. Natural gas use is off about 1.3% in this country. Prices are off dramatically, down to under $4 per MMBTU out of Henry Hub. Oil prices the same way as we're painfully aware of here in the state. Unconventional rapid expansion in that time frame of shale gas, and I know Porter's going to talk at length about that expansion. We are also seeing a change of national administration and more than likely a greater amount of limitations on land access, OCS access potentially, for oil and gas exploration. You saw the first slowdown in Utah. The policies of the new administration are stated to not be as pro-opening up of new areas for exploration and development. I'm not saying that's a bad or a good policy. I'm saying that's just the reality of our national cycles and national priorities. The same time in these western lands, there are huge, where a lot of our natural gas comes from, there are huge conflicts over land use, whether it's grazing rights, whether it's energy development, whether it's recreational, or whether it's individual homesteads, small homesteads that are being built out in the west. So in that conflict, you can expect increased limitations and potential decrease of access to some areas that might be some of these upside areas from a resource basis for non-conventional gas. And I put it down as a question mark. Certainly the OCS policy that's being formed by Secretary Salazar now will play a big role on whether we see expansion in the Atlantic or the West Coast, where some of the other large areas for natural gas potential might be, in addition to traditional producing areas. Finally, I'm going to really talk a little bit about two other points. The first is a lot of gas in the Arctic. The most recent assessment, the first international assessment, show Arctic Alaska in the lead, basically, of almost all the Arctic basins with respect to gas and oil. And then what happens if we do go into, as the Waxman bill does or other potential legislation does, limit carbon gas emissions on a national level? What does that do to the demand for natural gas, and what does it do to the likelihood or the value of our project from a national policy perspective?
Senator Wagner has a question.
You mentioned the Arctic and the gas fields up there. We have a lot of associated gas with oil production, and it seems to be a tremendous amount of gas. And number one, what causes that to happen in place, and how do you see that compared to what they're going to find on the outer continental shelf when they drill there? Is that basically the same geological structure that runs out that way?
In a lot of ways, the underlying geologic source rocks that generate the oil and gas continue out into the Beaufort and Chukchi Sea. So it's a replay of what you see onshore. And Alaska, probably nationally, is the most prolific generator of hydrocarbons in North America in terms of the number of source rocks we have, the richness of those source rocks, and the great geologic structures that we have, both onshore and offshore. We also are blessed with a continental margin that has a huge sedimentary cover, great-looking structures like the Berger structure that had 14 TCF of gas in the Chukchi. So when your first few wells find a supergiant field, it's telling you something. So big size potential in the offshore. On the onshore, we pull not very many holes, as I show, but enough holes to think that's not likely we'll find another Prudhoe Bay. But if there's another Prudhoe Bay, it's out there in the Chukchi or out there in the Beaufort. So big structures, lots of potential out there. Associated gas is an important issue because we already have an oil pipeline, and we have fields that are in decline. So producing that association gas really prolongs the life of the oil fields at this point in time. So we get the benefit of gas production not from non-associated gas in that case, but you get the benefits of gas on top of already existing infrastructure for oil. So it makes the production cost shared between the gas and oil, makes the gas cheaper to produce. And you'll see some numbers later that one of the reasons some of the Alaska's gas is very, very competitive at low prices is because that existing infrastructure in Prudhoe Bay, for example, and the potential Point Thompson, the liquids carry much of the cost of development. And the ultimate gas production comes really at the transportation costs and the operating costs additional to the field, which are relatively minor. In new field development, you have the field costs. We'll talk about those being conventional fields, bearing non-conventional fields, and generally cheaper to develop, less wells required, higher productivity weights per well. So if I look here at what's happened, the price response to the fall below $4 has been a dramatic decrease. 45% of the gas rigs have been laid down in the last year. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time, but that means that the lower 48 gas is extremely price sensitive to the current price environment. So we're at the spot where if you lay down 45% of your rigs, you can't sustain anywhere near the current level of production unless you pick some of those rigs up in the relative near future. You won't see that decline in production in the next year, but within 2 or 3 years, and you will see, and I think hopefully Porter will address that a little bit in the shorter term, but dramatic, you have to keep drilling gas wells, particularly in non-conventional or tight gas sands, in order to promise deliverability. So we'll see the massive declines and what happens when the economy recover and prices. There's some interesting scenarios that I won't talk about. The reality is, and I think maybe there's some confusion that's been created about Porter's presentation and the short-term issues, the next few years in a recession, in an overvalued market with limited pipeline infrastructure to get all that discovered gas to market versus a long 10 or 20 or 30-year viewpoint. And you can see here Jim Mulva's viewpoint is you can't look at the next few years as the driver for a pipeline. You've got to look up that long-term demand, long-term price of getting that gas to market, and competitiveness of our project given alternative sources. So here's the EIA's latest forecast, the 2009 forecast, and it goes out to 2030. And what you notice is a big increase in non-conventional gas. And in fact, right now, non-conventional gas, it's about 47% of our lower 48 production. By 2030, it'll be 56%. That's a dramatic increase. You can see offshore non-conventional on the left slide. This has got a laser on it. Going up dramatically. You can see conventional gas declining. So when you look at new gas supplies coming on, you've got to realize that often they're replacing existing conventional supplies that are in rapid decline. So there's a balancing effect. Also, you'll see Alaska gas, as the EIA's forecast, coming in and being a significant player in the EIA's viewpoint in its most recent forecast. Finally, you don't base your demand because no one knows 100% what the future looks like. And so EIA runs a series, as do most folks, run a series of forecasts on demand. You can see on the right they have a slow to a high case. All those cases, though, take a dramatic increase in gas. You can see the right, you don't see demand for gas decreasing, you see it increasing dramatically. You also see about 2018 of Alaska gas time, a dramatic increase in the demand for gas in their models. Again, very good timing for Alaska gas.
Let me just announce Representative Ramirez has joined us and Commissioner Pat Galvin is in the audience as well.
Thank you. So when we look at prices are going to drive this. You know, will this flood of new gas into the market lower prices in the long term? Well, certainly that's not the view of any of the published forecasts that I've seen. Again, the short term, absolutely. You can see the dive down there, but you can see Wellhead and Henry Hub expectations 2030. And you can see the price varies depending on the low, high, and demand case. But all of those prices are well above the needed return on an Alaska gas pipeline to make it very profitable. Just to point out, the AGEA founding took into account a wide variety of different scenarios. We are well within the range of expected outcomes that were modeled in the AGEA finding. So this is not unexpected. So jump into shale gas, about 5% of domestic production. Again, when you look at 2007, about 47% of domestic production came from non-conventional gas. Shale gas is only one part of non-conventional gas. If you want to think about gas in general, oil in general, mining in general, you hit the richest, most lucrative, easiest to produce conventional resources first, right? Because they're cheaper, they take lower technology, and you can produce them at higher rates and make more money. Over time, though, those resources dwindle. Our conventional resources in the lower 48, except for the deepwater offshore and Alaska, and potentially Atlantic and West Coast margins, have been heavily explored for. And those conventional resources are in rapid decline because we've depleted them. So we have gone to the unconventional resources, coal bed methane, tight gas sands, deep basin-centered sands, and now shale gas. Those are typically more expensive, require higher technology, and are produced in effect when you're in the later stages of production in the maturity in basins. So we're seeing gas that's refilling the conventional declining gas in the lower colors down there being replaced by these gases. Shale gas is a relatively minor player still compared to particularly the West, the Rockies, tight gas sands, and coal bed methane in multiple basins. But it's going to gain. So again, just to show you again, this is Wyoming. Conventional gas resources were becoming increasingly difficult, smaller accumulations, more difficult to produce. Non-conventionals become a much greater part of the portfolio. That's to be expected. That will happen in Alaska too, but first we'll get to those sweet conventional resources, which is why Alaska gas has such great economics. Shale gas occurs, again, I won't spend much time because I know I don't have much, in many, many different basins. Its closest analog might be coal bed methane, but in many cases, shale gas contains water and has to be dewatered. In other cases, it's dry and you have to add water to fracture the reservoir to produce it. So different techniques, different basins. There is no single type of shale gas, just like there's no single type of conventional oil or gas play. There's a wide variety of heterogeneity to these reservoirs, and they have a wide variety of economic costs and development strategies depending on the geochemistry, the quality of the shale, the source rock, whether it's naturally fractured, whether it's ductile or brittle as a shale, and its depth, and the ease of extraction due to surface conditions, access, water availability, land use policies, royalty rates, environmental policy of the local district. So a huge amount of variation on the cost structure. It's like saying when you start looking at shale gas as a general, you know, what's the cost to drive your car, to drive a car? Well, a lot depends whether you have a Jaguar or a Volkswagen Beetle. Starts out, you know, is it a school bus or is it a two-passenger car? To lump it all together means you have a wide variety of ranges of costs and expectations, fuel costs, driving costs, acquisition costs, capital costs, etc. So lumping it together, it's not a simple equation. But I'll give you some numbers based on the best sources I could find. The North Slope, USGS did an extensive amount of what new field development, what the pipeline costs on. You've heard from Mr. Palmer with their estimations of about $276 to get the gas to market from existing infrastructure. Again, improving oil and gas fields that have already produced oil that have most of the infrastructure there, very little capital or operation cost to get the additional gas. So cost will be around $3 to break even at the ECO hub. As we look in the foothills, generally the USGS used numbers of about $4.25. These are peer-reviewed, objective, publicly available sources. Again, I try to use those whenever possible. I could not find the similar quality data for shale gas. This is from Bank of America, showing a low end at the high-grade stuff about 425, a medium about 660, and a high end, at NYMEX, not at Henry Hub, so there's a basis difference between those hubs, about 1150. So you can see, basically, Alaska gas either is under or about the low end of the best shale gas. Now, technology will change things. Technology improves, and drilling rigs laid down are cheaper to acquire, so drilling costs will go down for shale gas. At the same time, steel costs for the Alaska pipeline have gone way down, so those tariff structures go down. So there's a balance and equilibrium here where high prices in fuel means development costs go up for everybody, and lower costs, less demand, means those development costs go down. So I would argue there's a relative parity. And in fact, for that first Alaska gas, if you can buy the steel cheaper in the next few years or commit to it, you've got a heck of a deal because your base gas in Prudhoe Bay is being cycled as we speak.
And let me take this opportunity to welcome Speaker Chenault this year. And let me ask you a question. The lower figure you have for onshore North Slope gas, $3, I assume you're taking into account that's $2.76 roughly for the tariff, and then you're figuring a CapEx operating
very small, yeah, very small OPEX costs and a little bit of capital costs. And this includes the treatment plant. So you've separate the 267 includes those costs. Okay. The 425 is new field costs, developing of a new field and feeder pipelines and OPEX associated with that in the foothills onshore.
So just
offshore numbers would be a little higher.
The 425 is
break-even.
Break-even, but the 425 is for a totally new field outside of Prudhoe Park.
Yes, but onshore, on state lands onshore. There's a price deck of numbers we can share that the USGS used when it did its technically and economically recoverable numbers a couple years ago.
Thank you.
They're public. Arctic Alaska has a huge amount of gas. In fact, one of the two highest areas of potential in the most recent assessment. In fact, if you look at the quantity and the size of the prize in Alaska, it's about 36% of the national total for undiscovered conventional estimates. And if you look then, compare it relatively to continuous or non-conventional gas, the USGS numbers, these are December 2008, so they're pretty current numbers, about 364 TCF of technically recoverable, non-economically recoverable. It would have to have a range of prices within that that price from low to high to recover all that gas. So you'd probably need $11, $12 gas to get at these sorts of numbers, and lack of environmental restrictions on getting access to the resource. Without coal bed methane, that number is very large. Alaska gas numbers are similar. I won't spend a lot of time going through the numbers. These are USGS and MMS assessments, but fundamentally we're looking at numbers that are roughly at parity to lower 48, but it's conventional, not non-conventional gas resources. How much of Alaska is economic? I showed you that price deck. This is the one province in Alaska, the undiscovered, technically recovered, non-associated gas in the Central North Slope, 33 TCF. Under various price scenarios, you can see at that $4 to $5 to $6 range, much of the gas is recoverable. And you can see on the left side, it takes about $4 gas, approximately, to start recovering new field development away from infrastructure on the Central North Slope. So this is consistent with that 425 figure. Again, it's like your car. Fields are going to cost different amounts to develop depending on where they are, the quality of gas, number of wells drilled, whether horizontal or vertical, what's in the gas, whether you have to treat out CO2 or not, et cetera. But so these numbers are generalized, but they put apples, the best apples comparison I can give you between the two resources. EIA's viewpoint the same. Much at their price forecast, much of Alaska's gas is commercial. Is commercial. Large, very, very large quantities of gas. Point out that if you look and overlaid Alaska, again, this immature province, only a handful of gas wells have ever been drilled for exploration, and you look at Wyoming, the density of wells is 80 times our density. So as we drill more wells, you can assume we're going to find a lot more gas. And that doesn't even talk about the non-conventional gas. So to date, coal bed methane and natural gas hydrates have been assessed for technically recoverable numbers. It's about 100 TCF. But the largest sources in the lower 48, and probably the largest source in Alaska, the overpressured basin-centered gas, the tight gas sands, has not yet been assessed. And that number potentially will be very large. So we add up the 227 TCF of undiscovered potential, put the proven reserves of 36 on top of that, put another 100 TCF. You're talking real gas. You're talking very, very large quantities. This is just to show you the technical recoverable numbers for hydrates, non-conventional. Then finally, I want to talk a little bit about one of the scenarios that say, what happens if we go into a carbon-constrained environment? And if you look at the IPCC, the International Panel on Climate Change, excuse me, the CCSP, the national program, which I was a member of in my GS days, pretty much all the assessments are saying the same thing, that if you don't mitigate carbon now, you're going to see an increase in global temperatures, and it has to be relatively soon. Again, we can argue whether folks believe it or not, but it's a consensus of the scientific community, basically, that there is an anthropogenic, a man-made effect, that we don't fully understand all the feedback mechanisms, but if you increase greenhouse gases, there's a natural increase of temperature. So if you're trying to limit that, you have to mitigate man-made CO2. And if the administration and the Congress chooses to do that, they will do it through either a cap and trade, a taxing mechanism, or other mechanism. That changes your fuel strategy dramatically, and it shifts you toward natural gas. So we had our consultants run a case, and over the baseload case, and they saw about 14 BCF increase in demand from their base case. I've seen other cases up to 20 BCF now. They're starting to come out. The EIA forecast does not yet take that into account.
Let me ask you a question on that. In your, are you assuming that natural gas is not taxed at all in cap and trade? And what are you assuming is taxed?
It's about $35 a ton for CO2 for all sources, was what was modeled in this case.
So there would be a tax for natural gas. It would just,
yes,
be less.
It'd be less. And it's per ton of carbon.
And just relative speaking, how many tons does natural gas emit?
It's about a third of what a coal-fired power plant produces. Right. But I don't know the full quantity of the number for it.
Okay. Thank you.
Also, gas-fired power plants are about a third as expensive to build than a coal-fired power plant, so they're cheaper in capital costs. And if you dramatically change the shift, short of having massively available carbon sequestration capacity for coal plants, and we aren't there yet on the scale necessary to do the sort of limitations on growth of CO2. To get to that additional growth, in as well as the national growth that we showed you in basically in all the scenarios, you have to have a lot more gas. Alaska gas, LNG, shale gas, conventional gas. So you need a huge supply. So it's not going to be one source that supplies it, but it's going to be multiple sources. And it raises the price, the value of natural gas in the marketplace, at least as we've modeled it. So you can see the blue, the carbon-based price. You can see the dip. That's a dip there in 2018. That 2019, that's when Alaska gas comes in. EIA estimates Alaska gas will lower price to consumers about 63 cents per MCF at Henry Hub, off Henry Hub spot, because of the gas coming in the market. And then over time, the market will recalibrate. But you'll see then a relative delta increase in price. Again, good for Alaska's gas prospects. What happens with LNG? It's interesting. In recent times, there was predictions LNG would flood the market. What's happened is, because we have shale gas, because we have other domestic sources of gas, and we actually will increase production, LNG has not come to our shores. We have about 12 times the regas capacity, I think it is, versus the amount of gas that comes in. We are way overbuilt with regas capacity. So what's predicted in this latest EIA model is that natural gas from LNG will increase to about 2018 and then will decrease. So, you know, this is their scenario. Canadian gas will decrease because the basins are being depleted overall. But you can see in there an increase in LNG that we have not yet seen. One of the reasons we haven't seen it is other basins, other areas of the world value it more. They value it about 6-to-1 parity to oil. We were 8-to-1, 10-to-1. Parity. So we will not pay as much as the other markets because we have the alternative gas sources. Finally, some folks have claimed that in the long term, the availability of other sources of gas in the lower 48, whether it be LNG, shale, non-conventional gas sources, will lower the long-term forecast for natural gas. Here's the EIA's most recent forecast in red. It is higher than the 2004. Higher than the 2006 forecasts that were used. So what we're seeing here is more bullish price estimations, even with that increase in supply. And I think I've shown you the why is the worldwide demand, population demand, national demand, decrease of conventional supplies, and more expensive alternatives are being developed, which puts Alaska, again, in a very good position to bring our gas in after much larger market has been developed by shale gas and power generation for natural gas has been created. Finally, I just wanted to show you where the pipeline is going to go through. That's Adigan Pass. I love to show the rocks because without the rocks, you don't get the gas. So on the right, the rocks are the Lisbon Formation, one of the real high potential targets in the limestones, very similar to what we see in much of the overthrust belt in Canada. So real optimistic presentation, perhaps, but perhaps not. If I'm an optimist, I share it with the best in the government and the best in the other agencies in the peer-reviewed literature. So with that, hopefully, that's been a quick, really quick and dirty throughput. Be happy to answer any questions if you want to do it now or afterwards.
Yeah, thank you, Dr. Myers. And just a quick question on page 32 of your slide. We heard yesterday from TransCanada that this new forecast adds about another $125 billion to the value to the governments and to the producers. Is that comport with what your understanding
yes.
is?
Yeah, because again, if the price goes up, provided your costs, if your infrastructure is in or your steel's paid for and you built your pipeline, you know, the tariff's going to stay pretty darn constant over the life of the pipeline. So your costs would be the variance in the cost to develop those resources. So once you have developed the field, let's say you're taking gas out of Prudhoe Bay, your OPEX and your CAPEX stay pretty much the same. Your pipeline tariffs are pretty much the same. So incrementally, the price you really gain on. Conversely, when the price goes down, you lose significantly. So that's why it's really important to understand the break even. It's really important to understand the rate of return, say a net present value of 10% or 15% gives you. So when you saw the AGEA numbers, they not only said it's not break even, it's a net present value of 10%. So a minimum 10%. I think probably TransCanada's numbers were at an NPV 10 as well. If that makes any sense.
Thank you. Any other questions for Dr. Myers? And are you available to stay through the Porter Bennett?
I am.
Presentation,
yes.
Great, because we may have some questions for you afterwards as well.
Sure.
Thank you. Mr. Bennett.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I would kind of like to do a little pre-introduction of Mr. Bennett. A lot of us saw him in a presentation in Washington, D.C., and thought it was probably, in my opinion, the simplest, easiest thing to understand gas presentation I've ever sat through. It was almost in layman's terms, and I appreciate it so much because that's sort of what I am in this field. And that's kind of the reason we ask him here. He is not paid by the state. We're covering his expenses, and he's volunteered to be here. And for that, we appreciate it because I think we're a sponge for knowledge, and we're trying to learn as much as we can. And so that's a little bit of the background is how Mr. Bennett got here. And I just wanted to kind of state that so everyone knew the whereabouts as to why he was here.
Great. Thank you,
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Appreciate that, Representative Johnson. And welcome to the committee, Mr. Bennett. And if possible, I know Mr. Myers went very quickly. If you could give you equal time, maybe 40 minutes or so, and then if we had a few minutes at the end for maybe questions for both of you, I think that would probably be beneficial. So welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity to be with you. This presentation, you know, when I did it in Washington, was about an hour presentation, so I'm going to blow through lots of it very quickly. And you know, please interrupt me if you have questions as you go, and be happy to answer them. Basically, there are 5 points to what I'm going to say. The energy world is changed pretty radically, I think, in the process of the last 2 years. Technology has changed the way natural gas is developed and produced in the country, and that's having a profound impact on the market. It's to the point where you can't consider gas unavailable. If you go back to 2003, 2005, there were a lot of literature that said that we were running out of gas, that peak gas had occurred just like peak oil. I think the performance of the industry in the last couple of years has definitely obliterated that concept. Okay, great. Thank you. Due to the unconventional gas production, the U.S. is currently supply long. We have a lot more gas than we have demand. That's likely to persist for quite a while, in my opinion. Prices are falling, and it's turning out to be a much better fuel from a customer standpoint than I think people thought it would be a few years ago. There's issues though. I mean, the burgeoning supplies are definitely taxing the system of pipelines. There are a number of constraints in the country, and those are taking what the impact of a constraint is it takes a price and drives it down farther because it stimulates gas on gas competition, which then reduces the price. So I'll talk a little bit about that, and then I think gas now is poised to provide a unique solution to some of our energy problems. If we're really serious about reducing our use of foreign oil, of reducing our emissions of carbon, gas is an answer, and I think that's probably very important for the gas industry to pursue. I'm going to go through the gas, you know, kind of the last year or two's performance, then talk about technology, some of the impacts, the recent activity in drilling, because I think that's important. It has a big impact on prices today. And then finally, some conclusions. There's a slide in here that talks about Bentec. I'm going to pass over it. Anybody that has questions, I'd be happy to talk to you about it. Over the last couple of years, production has increased significantly. It started in the summer of 2007 is when it really started to grow. These are EIA 914 numbers. You can see that the blue is kind of the beginning of the increase. Prior to 2007, it was growing at about, in 2006 and 5, it grew at about an 1.5 to 2% a year rate. Last year, it grew about 6%, almost 7. At the same time, demand increased somewhere between 1 and 2%, depending upon what source you look at. So the gas in the lower 48 is definitely building relative to demand supplies. You can see the impacts of the hurricanes in there. If you look at it in historical context, 2008 is just about the highest we've produced in the country's history. It was a little bit higher in the early 70s, but we're very close to a historic level of production in the lower 48. Had we not had the recession hit last fall, I believe that this year we would have passed that number. It's only because of the recession and the impact of drilling that we'll talk about later on in the presentation that we've not surpassed those numbers, or we won't surpass those numbers this year. When you look at where gas increased around the country, it's important to note that it grew pretty much everywhere. The only place it fell off is in the Gulf of Mexico and then the San Juan Paradox basins. This map shows, I've accumulated production by basin. This is based on our data that we collect from the pipelines. We collect all the receipts on pipelines. We get that data daily, so we have a very current estimate of what's produced, what's consumed around the country. And this is shown on a an aggregated basis. So you can see that the Gulf dropped about 600 million a day. And the interesting thing is, had we done this graphic, showed you this graphic in August, it would have actually been down less than 100 million a day. That's the impact of the hurricanes. The Gulf has actually been holding its own over the last couple of years, a couple of major new platforms down there, and so Gulf production has not declined anywhere near as much as it was in the mid-2000s and earlier. But when you get to the Rockies grew by over a billion a day. That's the impact of tight sands, primarily unconventional power, coal bed methane production. You go to the southeast, what we call the southeast supply area. Southeast supply area is comprised of the Arkoma, Arkla, East Texas, and Fort Worth basins. Those basins are primarily the shale. That's the new shale that people are talking about. That grew by over 3 Bs a day last year. Then if you go to Appalachia, Appalachia only grew by 200 million last year, but it was 200 million the year before. The important point is that's where Marcellus is. And so that's an area that's going to grow farther in the future. The other point is the Anadarko and Permian. Those are conventional, primarily conventional. There's some shale work going on down there, but mostly that's conventional production. And even that grew a little bit last year. There was a big pipeline built out of the Rocky Cheyenne Plains that was put in place in the 2005 timeframe. That was designed to fill production into Mideast pipeline or Midwest pipelines that that were expected to decline in flows because of the declines in the Anadarko and Permian, and they actually didn't materialize, and so that gas got stranded. It's one of the reasons we built RECs. If you the other thing that's important is to recognize that the percentage mix across the country, if you think of the market share in the lower 48, has changed pretty radically. The Rockies in 1980 produced about 3% of the gas consumed in the country. By 2000, it was about 15. Now it's about 20. About 20%. The Southeast supply area, the big growth area, only produced about 9% of the gas produced in the country in 2000. Now it produces 25%. Appalachia was essentially insignificant, less than a percent in 1980, and now it's about 4%. So that the productive production, where it's produced and how it fits in, is really changing, and you'll see that in a minute here. The reason it's growing is non-conventionals, and this is primarily, you can see it's hard to, I just was at a conference the last couple of days on unconventional gas, and it was pretty interesting. This is a graph I had put together, but actually there's a number of other things that you can see now. The horizontal here is the is primarily shale gas or unconventional, and it's a different way of drilling than they have used in the past. It's been around, as you can see, since 1990, but really over the last two or three years they've learned how to use it. Interestingly enough, they're starting to use it in some of the conventional plays too. And so that it's really kind of taking over. Directional drilling is more of a tight sands approach. It allows them to put multiple wells off a single pad. It's a different kind of deal. But again, it's a new technology. Fracking is a very important part of both of those technologies. What fracking here is this is really an example of a vertical, the vertical part of there. If the well stopped at the end of that vertical post, that would be a vertical well. That's the way it used to be done. And if you noticed, if you took the straight down and you just hit the bottom of that dark brown, you would have a very small area of your well that could get gas. Well, what they're doing now with the horizontal is they'll come down and then move it across, which allows them to bring gas out of a considerably larger area underground. Then they put the fracs in. What those are mixtures of sand, water, and sometimes ceramic proppants, what they call it. They force that in under high pressure, and it breaks the rock. Shale is very, very dense. It's a lot denser than concrete. It's a very, very dense rock. And so they put that proppant through and force it to splinter, and they'll get gas to flow to the well stem. What they do is they typically now, in the early days, say you go back two or three years, they would maybe frack it once or twice. Some of the wells now are fracked 10, 12 times before they actually bring them on, so that by the time they come on, there's a tremendous amount of gas coming into the system. It's really changed the production out of a well. One of the producers was saying in 2007, one of their average wells generated about $900 million a day in the first year of, after about 60 days of production. By this year, that same area was producing 2.1 Bs a day. So over twice, an increase of over 100%. Basically out of the same well in the same location, just because of different kinds of fracking technique.
Representative Newman.
Thank you. So when I'm looking at this, is this the reason why not as many wells will have to be drilled for shale gas? Because that's been one of the components of whether we've heard that shale gas is not going to be developed because there's so many wells have to be drilled.
No, this isn't really the issue, because this in itself isn't going to be a problem unless there's environmental regulation on fracking, which is being proposed. I mean, this is an issue that is it's a significant one for the industry. The states regulate fracking now, and there's been talk, and I think there's going to be an attempt at the EPA to bring that under EPA supervision. That would not be a good thing for gas production in the United States. Wouldn't be a good thing for oil production. Generally would not be a good thing, I don't think. Any other questions? But there's another, I'll come back to that question in a minute, because I've got another slide that really kind of talks about it. There's another aspect to it that's important. If you look at what's happened over the last two or three years, it's a result of a very large investment by the producing community in the United States, almost $1 trillion. If you go back to the U.S. and Canada, that's been able to happen because of the prices, the price levels of the last 6-7 years. If you go, people say that it took $13 gas last year to precipitate this. That's wrong. It took about $6-7 gas to precipitate it. The reason it's wrong is most of the production gains that we saw last year had to be started two or three years prior before gas prices ever got anywhere near $13, except for on a very short-term period basis after the hurricanes hit in 2005. So it's a result of a significant investment on the part of producers to make this happen. And as a result, gas prices are on their way down. This is shown through March. It just shows the Henry Hub price. That's NYMEX. That's where NYMEX is settled. And it shows the price, and it's down. Actually, I haven't seen what happened today, but my guess is it's down in the 350 to 340 range. And as you'll see in a minute, that's the Henry Hub price. That's not the price that's paid around the country in the market area. It's important to recognize what I spent a minute ago talking about, where the geography of production and how it's changed. This is showing where production was in 1980. The size of the circle is a function of the total production out of the field. Your slides probably don't have this one very well. It kind of lays everything on top, I'm afraid. But this is the production levels in 1980. By 1990, I want to back that up a second. Notice the pipeline structure is all the production is mostly out of the Gulf, and in 1980 over half the gas produced in the United States came out of the Gulf or that Gulf area. And most of the pipeline structure was really designed to get gas out of that area and then the Anadarko Permian and move it to the Northeast and Midwest where most of the demand was. By 1990, things had started to change. Green signifies growth, red signifies decline. You can see that by 1990, we'd started to see production in the Rockies, but the areas, that little dot in the middle of Texas, that's Fort Worth Basin, that's where the Barnett Shale is. And so in 1990, that was actually declining in a relatively small production area in the country. And again, notice the colored pipelines that are coming up are new pipelines built in the decade. And so if you notice, by 2000, we're starting to see a lot more production out of the Rockies. You still see growth in the Gulf. The area along the coast has started to decline in Louisiana. That red dot at the top of Louisiana is where the Haynesville gas, that's the Arkla Basin, that's the Haynesville, that's the big dog that's emerging right now in the industry. And is even as recent as 2000, that was declining and relatively small, and Fort Worth was even smaller in 2000. By the end of last year, we've got a very different situation. You can see most of the gas is coming out of the East Texas, Northern Louisiana area, the Rockies, and now we also have what's emerging in the Pennsylvania area, the Marcellus production. But notice the pipeline system hasn't changed very much, and that's wherein lies the capacity issues that I'm going to talk about next. You look at the price implications of what prices look like. If you take the Henry Hub is the settlement price for NYMEX, and so we take that as ground zero, that's the basis of pricing in the United States. Okay, what I've shown here in the blue is the prices in local areas. So if you're up in Northeast, in Boston, New York, you're paying approximately $1.23, or you paid in 2008, on average, $1.23 more than the price in at Henry Hub. It's a little bit higher in Florida. Chicago's a little bit lower, but TECO in Ohio is about 30 cents. In the Rockies, or in the West, where you start to get into the producing areas, you're under. In other words, the area that is red, those areas are supply long. They got too much gas relative to demand. The areas that are blue are supply short. They have too much demand relative to supply. The way the market works is to try to balance those two out. Thus, you see pipelines built. This is the Rockies Express. This is the new one that's coming online this next month. It's bringing gas out of the Rockies. It's trying to get that low-cost gas to the higher-priced market. And so that's being built. That'll be the first one, but it's far from a lone soldier. There's 75 different pipeline projects in the Gulf. There's another 45-plus that are being built in the Northeast to get access to less costly gas. And there's another, actually, it's 10 projects that are being built in the Rockies, or being considered in the Rockies, to move additional supply into the market area, because we're still, as you'll see in a minute, we're still pipeline constrained. So Let's I want to show you the now for real quickly go through what the Rockies look like, because this kind of gives you an idea of how pipeline capacity works with price. This is the Rockies. You can move gas out of the Rockies in a number of different ways, but they really simplify down to three. You can move it to the northwest, up to the Pacific Northwest, which is where the BC produced gas also comes in, so that's the competitive market for that. You can also move it to the southwest, to Arizona, Nevada, California, and then you can move it east. The flows to the northwest, what this is showing is the daily flow. The blue is the daily flow on the pipelines. The red is the capacity on those pipelines. So you can see going to the northwest, we've been running at 99, 97, very high 90% capacity utilization rates for most of the last 3 years. Actually, that goes back to about 2005. The southwest, same, they're full both directions. And in the one in the upper right, that's the flows going east out of Cheyenne generally. What you can see is the capacity was constrained in 2007. It opened up a little bit there when the capacity increased. That's Rex coming online. That was the first part of Rex. And then it fell off. There was, as Rex came on, there was a dip, and the dip is a maintenance event on Rex, where they shut part of it down for a while. And then the space that's there is actually cold weather in the Rockies. When we get cold weather in Colorado, that pipeline tends to open up. Not as much gas is available to move out.
Senator Wagner.
What's the breakdown on the gas coming out of the Rockies as to conventional versus
conventional,
non-conventional?
It's, let's see. I'm not sure the exact number. I'm guessing it's... driven by the Green River. Green River's mostly tight sands. So I would say it's probably at least 75% unconventional. It's a lot of it's coal bed methane. Up in the area, it's above that map. Here, I'll show you some. Okay. This is the Powder River. That's coal bed methane primarily. This is the Bighorn right there. That's conventional. This is conventional mostly, although they're starting to do some tight sands things there. This is the big dog. This is where the most of the gas, the biggest area of production in the Rockies. That's where Jonah Pinedale are. Those are the two big fields. That's tight gas. And then this is Uinta, Piance. Those are both primarily tight gas, a little bit of conventional. This is the Paradox. This is conventional, but they're just found a couple of major discoveries there in shales. And then this is the San Juan, which is a coal bed methane. Over here in the Raton, this is, I think that's coal bed methane, to be honest with you, I'm not sure. And then DJ, this is an oil, an oily area, and it is it's a lot of conventional, but they're doing a lot of horizontal drilling in that area. That's a good example of where the unconventional technologies have been applied to a conventional reservoir, and they've prolonged the life and expanded the production dramatically out of that over the last few years. I consider that to be the ever-ready bunny of the gas industry. That field or that basin, it just keeps going. Okay, now this is looking at the capacity and flows out on an aggregate basis for the Rockies, and let me the blue and the gold, those are total supply. Total supply breaks into what you can export and then what you consume or put into storage in the region, which is what the gold is. The red line is capacity. That's the total capacity out of the Rockies. And then the green line is price measured at Opal, which is the primary pricing point in the Green River, which is, as I said, the big production area in the Rockies. There are a couple things to note here. Number one is the red line. The red line fluctuates dramatically. That's the fluctuations are due to maintenance. And when the maintenance happens, you lose productive capacity and the price tends to go down. You notice in the 2007 period, the average utilization rate was 103%. That's when we had what we call our not so affectionately, Rockies experience producers in the Rockies received on more than one day that summer 5 cents for their gas. There were many days sub 75 cents. And what happens is that you get behind a constraint on the pipeline, and all of a sudden you've got people buying, you know, got more produced sellers than you do consumers. Consequently, they bid the price down. Now, there are very few long-term contracts here, so that as a result, you know, that's, you know, you, when you get a constraint like this, it drives the price way, way down. As soon as RECs came on in this period here, it alleviated the situation, and last year we had about a 97% utilization rate, and it wasn't until the end of the year when we had the maintenance problems on RECs that the prices fell down, and so at the end of the year the price was about 75 cents for several days.
Got a question from Senator Wagner.
What's your green line going to look like, say, out additional 6 months and out additional 12 months?
Can
you speculate on that?
Well, today the price at Henry Hub is about $3.50.
Right.
Yesterday, I think the price at Opal was $2.25, so that it would be about where it is now, a little bit later. This summer, we expect it will be down many days below a dollar because there's just too much gas. We'll talk to that. Let's come back to that question. I think it's the next graph, actually.
And you. Just on timing-wise, the initial agreement was a half hour. We went a little bit over with Dr. Myers. If you can wrap it up within 10 minutes so we can have an opportunity to have both, okay. that'd be great.
Well, then, let's see. This is an important one to understand. You asked a question earlier about why, whether the fracking. Well, this didn't work, but if you notice, this is what I've done here is I've taken an average well out of the Mam Creek, which is in the Piance. The red here is the first year's production. So if I drill one well during the first year, that's what it looks like. You get about 500,000 a day. But notice it declines very quickly. You drill that same well the next year, you get an incremental 244 because the balance goes to offsetting the declines from the first year's well. So to answer your question a minute ago, if you don't keep drilling more than one well, eventually this flattens out. And it's because you're having to replace the declines from the previous wells. You understand?
Hmm.
So that this is why when you talk about shale, one of the issues with shale is you have to keep drilling. If you don't keep drilling, you're going to end up with production dropping off very quickly. Now, the blue there represents, this is our same graph we had a minute ago. This is the actual flows through last month. And then this is the projected going forward. Now, this is a projection we did based on drilling rate. It's primarily driven by drilling rates. And we did this at the end of January based on the announced plans of producers at that time. And you can see we were looking at price problems all summer long. Since the end of January of this year, we've lost a lot more rigs in the Rockies. And as when that happens, it doesn't take very long at all for production to decline. In fact, this has gone from a situation where, based on the rigs that are projected for this year, we're not going to produce enough gas to even need this new pipeline that's already being projected, or it's actually not projected. They're actually working on this pipeline. Same thing with this one. These are billion-dollar projects, and they're not even necessary given this. Now, what that says is not those aren't going to get built. What this is saying is at this point, producers, right about in here, if you look at the forward curve says you start drilling right about here, and I think that'll probably move up. In other words, the forward price that you can get for gas if you sell it forward out in the Rockies is higher than your drilling costs. So producer, it's logical for them to drill again. Right now, the prices are below what they can get for their costs, so they're not going to drill. When it gets out to this point, they're going to start drilling. And what will happen is very quickly, they're going to bring it back up, but at some point next year, they're going to run into capacity problems again.
and that'll drive the price back down, same way it is right now.
So that eventually, so that this capacity issue is what constrains the price of natural gas in the lower 48. And as we go through this, let me just, this is a lot of Canadian gas comes across into the this is the east end of REX. So it ends in June, it'll get to Lebanon. Right now there's about 1.6 Bs a day coming into Lebanon. There's about 325 million a day of unused space going east of Lebanon. REX is going to, and there's about 250 local demand. REX is going to be 1.6 and bring 1.6 Bs into Lebanon. So what's going to happen? Obviously, you can't fit 1.6 into 325 million of space. So that means the price here is going to get dropped a whole bunch. Okay, but then at the end of the year, REX gets over to eastern Ohio. At that point, that 1.6 of capacity will come across here, so you got 1.9. So you got plenty of room to get gas into the pipelines here, but you've got this Marcellus production growing. And Marcellus is going to put in probably, we figure it's about a B a day this year, and it'll grow to 2 to 3 over the next 2 years. Only problem is when you get this, and it all goes into storage fields right here. Only problem is on a peak day in the winter, there's only a half a B's worth of open capacity east of those storage fields. So you can't, that gas is going to sit in the, it's going to sit in the storage field. You can think of it as a roach motel. It goes in, it can't get out. And it can't get out until until pipelines are expanded. Unfortunately, there's only about 100 million a day of expansions that are planned and to the point they're being developed and can be developed by 2011. So there's going to be a whole lot of gas here, which means over the next 2 to 3 years, prices are going to fall dramatically in this area. Now let's talk about the Gulf real quickly. This is the way the Gulf shapes up. These are the four big production basins in the Gulf. You have Carthage, Ship, Perryville, Henry, and Station 85. The premium price point is here. Everybody tries to get their gas from here to here, from which you can go up to the northeast. This is the way gas gets out of that market. The blue shows the utilization rate of the pipelines going to each of those directions. So this has about prior to last winter, had about a 1 B a day of unused capacity. This is a little bit more, about 1.5. This had virtually none. And this has about 2.5, but it doesn't count because that's a summer load. On a peak day in the winter, it's irrelevant. So there are 15 projects bringing a bunch of gas in to the Carthage. It goes across. There's another bunch that are going to Perryville. But notice at this point we're bringing 7.3 in if it fills, and there's 6.4 of incremental capacity. It starts full. So that means you've got about 900 million a day that can't get from here to here, so it's going to go fill that space up. That's already full. We've already seen that in the market this winter. Means there's another bunch of it that's going to go up there, and this is going to come back to the point where you end up with about 5 Bs of gas that can't find a home. And it can't find a home because there's no way to get it out of that region. But it gets a little bit worse because the impact of that REX going across that I just showed you, it means that some of that gas that's currently flowing to that area is going to get pushed back. It's going to have to discount itself right now it's about a 70 to 90% discount that's going to have to, the producers in this area are going to have to go in order to make that equalize.
Senator Wagner has a question.
So if I'm a producer, then why do I want to drill and produce gas that's costing me 5.5 per MCF to produce, and when I get it to the market, I'm going to take a loss of $3.5 to $4.
Well, that's why they're not drilling. That's why people have backed off the drilling right now.
So with the plays, and going back to this chart you showed on the continuation of the drilling production, so is what we're going to see there then is that decline is going to happen real quick because they're not going to drill there until the price goes back up. Is that correct?
Let's go to the next graphic. I'll show you what it is. This is when you get that REX gas, we figure there's probably another 900 million coming in that's trapped in this area. Now, what's important to recognize here is that this is Chicago. You got to go from the Gulf to Chicago. This is the Northeast. You got to go all the way up. These are long-haul pipelines that have to be built. These are probably of an average cost. They've got to be at least $6 or $7 billion to fix this problem. This is not. Nobody's talking about a solution here, and yet you can't get much more out of here right now. The only alternative to this is to build something down here, increase the demand. Exports is one option, but there's a lot of industrial demand in this area. If you know that could be a reason it comes back, but. This is different than the Rockies problem because the Rockies, there's two or three pipelines being planned to be fixed. This one isn't going to get fixed anytime soon. This is our forecast of production in the Gulf, and you notice when you get to capacity, by the end of this year, you've got a problem. And this is with the announced cutbacks that are there so far. But you're obviously going to need more cutbacks and drilling to get that to bring that production level down. I think what you're also going to see is a bunch of shut-ins. Producers are going to have to shut in gas, which is one of the interesting things that this technology change that's gone on is doing, is it's allowing producers, they're starting to figure out how to choke back their wells so that they can be able to cut them back when prices get really depressed. So this is, until this is fixed with some kind of a pipeline, this is a structural problem that the industry is going to have for a number of years. This is drilling activity across the country. This is, goes to your question, why would they do it? Well, they're not. This is the Permian Anadarko. These are two of the more expensive places to drill, and they've lost 120 wells. About 80% of their rigs have been laid down in these areas. But notice down here, the Haynesville. This is the big dog. And I'll explain that in just a second. But that's actually increased. It's black because it's an increase, not a decrease. These ones are all the number that have been laid down. In the southern Pennsylvania, that's the Marcellus. That's only lost, I think it's 8 rigs. It's very small on a number basis. Now this graphic is designed to show. First off, I've color coded the basins by whether they're predominantly conventional or whether they're predominantly unconventional of any sort, and they're sized based on the average production on a daily basis over the first 2 years of a well. So we've got production curves for a typical well drilled recently, last couple of 3 years. In each of these areas, and we said, okay, let's take the average production per day over the first 2 years and plot it here. The size of this circle is a function of that. So you can see this is the Haynesville, what I was saying. This is that 369 million a day, 3 Bs a day for an average well here. When you get up here in this area, it's about a B a day. And that's in the Rockies, that's the big dog. Down here, this is the East Texas, Bossier, that's deep sand, and that's somewhat unconventional. Some of it's conventional. That's the shales in the Barnett, but they're relatively small compared to this. And then you've got this Marcellus, which is relatively large too. Now let's look at where this is the percentage of declines in drilling over the last. And by the way, this percentage is compared to October 17th, the week of October 17th, because that's is generally the highest week of the last several years. So that's what I would consider the peak week, and since peak week. The Green River up here has lost 63% of its rigs. But the Haynesville has gained 8. And the reason is because you can produce so much more out of these wells down here cost about $10 million roughly. And you can produce so much out of that even with the price environment that we've got now, it makes sense to do it. At one level. Another reason this is happening is because leases. There was a lot of talk last fall about use it or lose it kinds of issues. on the federal property. Well, these, a lot of the leases here, this is all fee land. This is not federal land down here as a general rule. And most of those leases have three-year terms. They're private party leases. They have three-year terms. A lot of them have options. So producers have to drill out, or at least, you know, kind of stake a claim on their acreage in order to make it work and be able to hold the lease. So that's why that's going. These are very, very valuable leases. Same thing up here. You see a lot of things happen, activity there when you would think, you know, just looking at it on the surface, it shouldn't. And it's because there's a lease issue there to some degree. It's also, the other thing that this masks is these rigs aren't just going down. What's also happening is some of the rigs that were working here are now up here. Some of the rigs that were working here are over here. And the reason they're over there is because they're the new rigs. There's the technology is changing, and it's changing this whole market in another way. Is if you look at the and I'll just use Questar, they operate up here and they operate here. They are in this area right now. They have nine rigs running. Those nine rigs are drilling 20 wells a month. Last year, on October 17th, between September and October, it took them 12 rigs to drill 20 wells a month. A year ago, year and a half ago, it was 18 rigs to drill 20 wells a month. What's happening is they're taking their most efficient rigs and putting them on their most productive properties. And then they're also learning how to do it. It's know-how as much as technology. And I would submit we don't have any idea where this leads, is what it boils down to. You know, the technology is evolving so quickly here, and they're being so much more productive than they used to be, that it, you know, what that does, it changes all the models is what it does. You can't, you know, in math there's something called a discontinuous function, and that's really what this is in my mind. This is a sea change in the way gas is produced in this country. And so where this heads, all the things that I take away from this are, you know, there's a whole lot of gas out there, and it's going to be relatively low price for consumers. Is it going to be $3, $6, $7? I don't know. Going forward, I think in the next couple of 3 years, it's probably very unlikely to get over $5. But in 10 years, where you guys need to be, I can't say what that's going to be. I don't think it'll be much over $7 unless something happens that this, you know, technology chain fizzles. That could happen because all of a sudden we put a clamp on fracking. It could happen for who knows what other reasons. I don't think it's at all likelihood that you're going to see the $12 or $10, $12, $13 gas prices that people have been talking about for years for very good reasons. I mean, 2 years ago, that's what the answer would have been. I think at the current pace we're at right now, gas prices are going to fall dramatically this year and into next. Drilling declines are going to curb production, which will drive the prices back up a little bit, but they're not going to have to go up very far before all of a sudden the increased production that they stimulate hits the constraints and starts to drive the prices back down again. Technology and production are gonna work. They're magic, and I think the difference between where we are as a country and an industry today, and where, as say, 2000 or in the 90s, when we get these cycles, it took a long time and a whole lot of energy to fix the cycle, to get supply back over demand, so the price would fall down. I think it's going to happen much quicker, and so the price response will not be anywhere as near as volatile as it's been historically. You know, in order to expand the industry and expand production, expand demand, in many ways we have to think about pipelines. Pipelines are critical to the country. And the implications of this is demand, 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 demand. I can't say that enough. The country is set up to be able to use gas as the central fuel of its energy policy. It's low cost, it's low emissions, and it's abundant. And if the country grabs that and does it, I think we can produce a lot more gas in the country, not only in the lower 48, but up here,
There's a lot of gas that could be produced and could serve the country very, very well. If we don't do something about demand and we don't, you know, use it that way, and we keep demand in the 20 to 22, it, you know, carbon constraints will definitely increase it. But even to do things in the carbon constrained world, we've got to fix the pipelines too. It's not, they're not going to work without doing something on the pipeline side. So I mean, it's I think without working on the demand side of this, it becomes a real problem. So,
Mr. Bennett, thank you very much for that presentation. And at this time, I'd like to call up Dr. Myers, and we could get the lights back on. And I guess I'll open it up for questions from the committee members. Senator Wagner.
One of the things that you hear about, T. Boone Pickens got the good one-liner, you know, this is the fuel of the future for automobiles. But has anybody done any projections on the replacement of current, older, aging generation plants that are using coal now and also in compressed gas for vehicular propulsion, things like that? Are there any of those out there that we can get a hold of? And how will that affect the overall picture?
Senator Wagner, is the chair, about 51% of our electricity in the country is generated
coal.
By coal.
Yeah.
So that's the prime target as to what, whether we'll continue with coal, increase coal. Like I said, demand for electricity keeps growing. If you look at a 5 or 10 year slice rather than the bumps that occur cyclic, seasonal, and yearly, and short-term or long-term depressions aside, population growth and demand is increasing at a relatively predictable, steady rate for energy as population growth and, you know, as we use air conditioning. So if there's fuel switching to compressed natural gas or to fuel cells that are driven by natural gas, there's as Boone Pickens is talking about, there is a dramatic increase in demand. That is more and more likely as the price of gas is decoupled to oil. Remember that ratio of 6 to 1 that you see in Europe. If we stay at an 8 or 10 to 1 because gas is relatively abundant, there's a lot of incentive to switch to using natural gas as a transportation fuel. Secondly, if you go to electric cars, you still have to power the electrical grid. Electric car is going to another fuel source to generate the electricity. So as we see your scenarios out there, and that's when this carbon constrained is one example, but fuel load switching, gas to liquids, at some point people will start gas to liquids if that ratio between gas and oil stays high and we get the efficiency of gas to liquids down, we'll start seeing more and more gas to liquids in this country if gas is abundant. And I would argue one way to ship it out of the pipelines, the other is to put GTL plants locally where you have an excess of capacity and limited pipeline capacity to get it out. So we may see that potential. The key is maintaining a available source of supply that's relatively abundant and moderately priced, enough to keep the drilling going. And I agree that $6, $7, $8, maybe $9 range, depending what oil does, is a very valuable sweet spot. It's also, you saw Tony Palmer's numbers, the economics of Alaska gas is extremely profitable at those numbers. So you will see, I think, a very large, dramatic increase in need if the country makes those policy decisions and if oil availability and oil demand overseas is difficult. We are increasingly decreasing domestic production oil generally. Deepwater Gulf of Mexico is helping us a little bit. But what we do in the Beaufort and the Chukchi matters. But with that said, we can't drill our way out of the lack of energy. We cannot produce enough oil in this country to offset the amount we're importing. If you look at, we're up nearly, I guess, around 70% imports now. You know, back, wasn't long ago, where that was 50%. So you see increase in demand for oil, you'll see competition for more oil, and if oil prices go high, you'll start see fuel switching out of oil like you did for electrical generation and transportation fuels. So huge upside potential here. If gas is available and if prices stay in that moderate range, we have not seen gas power plants built, new gas power plants built despite increasing demand because of availability of the commodity and because of price volatility. Good. Utilities can't hedge. They can't hedge long-term prices to be sure historically. Now, maybe that's changing now, but all that's good news again because it grows demand for Alaska gas in that 10 to 20 to 30 year cycle.
Mr. Bennett?
There's tremendous, I saw the numbers the other day, and I can't remember what they are right off the top of my head, But when you look at gas consumption by power generation, you have to. It's very important to break it down by type. Gas is used by peakers. That's the stuff that goes up and down a lot. And then it's used in combined cycles. Combined cycles are typically shoulder to base load facilities. That means they run somewhere between 30 to 60, maybe 65, 70% on a high side. Right now, something like three-quarters of the gas-fired combined cycles, the shoulder technology, is unused in the country right now, is unused. It's unused primarily because of the price, what it's been over the last few years. Relative to coal, it's just way more expensive. Now, what you're starting to see is because gas prices are coming down, coal's having a little harder time competing. The problem with it, they don't work. You can't move from one to the other because long-term contracts tend to underpin the coal market, and so you can't just switch away the way you can gas. A lot of gas is a spot market fuel. Coal is not. And so that, you know, I think there's issues associated with that. Longer term, I think the obvious way to reduce our emissions of carbon, if we're really concerned about that, is to quit using as much coal as we are and use gas, and you could do it immediately. That would have a big impact. But again, it all depends on where the plants are located. If the plants are in upstate New York, you can use them in the summer because there's capacity there, but you can't use them in the winter because there's no capacity on a winter day. So that you got to be on the right side of the constraint at the right time to be able to add that load.
Okay, Dr. Myers, we've got a few more minutes. I want to give you an opportunity. You saw Mr. Bennett's presentation. Do you have any? Does it change your opinion at all about the viability of the Alaska Gas Pipeline? Is there things in there that you disagree with? And let me recognize that Senator Terrio's joined us also.
Fundamentally, I don't see a potential conflict. I mean, I think there's about three or four points I'd like to make. The first point is the next few years versus the long term. Long-term demand growth has occurred in spite of recession, in spite of alternative fuel sources, if the fuel is available. And now, if we're environmentally constrained, you'll see even more growth. So long-term growth and short-term aberration are very different. So, and I don't think there's a conflict there. There's certainly excess of supply in the current recessionary environment. Certainly the pipeline infrastructure is racing to build to keep up to deal with localized deltas in the lower 48. Now, Alaska Gas has some fundamental differences. First of all, that first gas produced is coming out of gas that's being cycled at 8.4 BCF per day. Cycled. It's not you have to drill new wells to keep up. It's how wide you turn the valve open to produce that gas. So we're looking at conventional wells that can easily be choked back, easily be increased beyond the capacity, design capacity of the pipeline. And as long as, again, we're in an environment in the fields where you don't have significant oil loss, you have a lot of latitude in controlling the rates and the choke back. So it's not like unconventional where you get rapid decline wells. These are going to be the first discoveries, whether they be in the foothills, whether they be in Prudhoe Bay, whether they be in Point Thompson, are going to be very conventional fields where you control it at the valve, depending on how much gas you take, subject to potential fields that are combined oil and gas together, where you have to manage the pressure maintenance, which is going to limit your offtake. But fundamentally, the management techniques, the approaches used are going to be different in conventional fields where you don't have that rapid decline, continued need to frack. The technology being used in the lower 48 is technology, much of it was developed up here. We have drilled, in fact, as a development or exploration geologist, we employed many Alpine as the horizontal wells, all horizontals. When I was the discovery geologist at the Meltwater field, we got zero flow on those first discovery wells prior to fracking, and we got 4,000 barrels per day of oil afterwards. And we knew that going in, that was highly likely. So much of the advanced fracture technology, horizontals, multilateral horizontals, are the way that the heavy oil is being developed on the North Slope. So again, these are technologies that have been evolved, and most of it's been a transfer of knowledge over to the lower 48 gas fields from Alaska. So the technology is an evolutionary technology, and I guess being a guy who spent a lot of time drilling wells, being involved with exploration and development in the upstream part,
I would say I believe the technology is not revolutionary, it's evolutionary. And there are limits on the rate of cost structure, and we ran them into the North Slope. Horizontal wells produce a lot more efficiently, but they're more expensive. And so technology advances, rates improve, but the rocks stay the same. And so the ability to produce those rocks, to frack efficiently, is definitely improving. But there are going to be limits on the technology based on the physics, the geology, the geochemistry, the depth, water use issues. So I would disagree a little bit in the rate that technology enhancement lowers cost. Does it allow us to produce reservoirs that are as unconventional reservoirs would not have been producible with earlier technology? Absolutely. Is it going to be revolutionary cheaper? I would argue no. Will it be evolutionary cheaper? Quite likely, if we mass produce the technology, use the best rigs, etc. So we're looking at, I would argue, as an evolution technology. Conventional gas cost and structure will beat it every time if that conventional gas is available and if the pipeline tariffs are reasonable.
Thank you. And Mr. Bennett, just give you a fair opportunity to respond.
I just absolutely disagree with that last statement. And if you look at the empirical evidence, you go back and look at XTO's security exchange filings, you look at any of the producers that are actually doing this, what they're finding is that the cost of drilling in shales is dropping dramatically. I mean, I sat through half a dozen presentations yesterday of producers operating down there. Their costs have gone from $6, $7, $8 last summer to down less than $3. A lot of them are looking at prices in the $1.20, $1.10 range as a F&D cost. They've still got lifting to get off of it, but that's not going to add much more than another dollar. The price and cost of this is coming down dramatically, and in many cases their conventional properties are more expensive now than they're unconventional. That's why the Permian and Anadarko, the drilling is off so badly there, is because that's a very expensive place to operate, and if you're not in the shale part of the Anadarko and the Permian, it's a problem. And so I just think that that's a I don't think it's right to characterize the unconventionals as more expensive anymore. The science is moving past that very quickly. Or the operational experience is moving past it very quickly. The other point that when I was saying it's revolutionary, I'm saying it from the standpoint of the market. I mean, I think that the impact on the market is really the issue. And to me, it's not for certain at all. I mean, there's no certainty in this, but it sets up the question mark. I realized as we were doing it, I left out the last point here, which was really probably, in many ways, the most important is that when you start building these projects, you need a feedback loop. You need to be able to watch the way the market's evolving, and see what it means. I mean, for example, everybody's been thinking LNG is going to be the big deal, and right now we're about to see two ships show up in Cove Point this next week or week after. I'll bet it knocks 25% out of the price of gas, because we don't have any place to consume it. And what the only reason those are coming here is because there's no demand anywhere else. And we got the only storage fields that you can use. Well, the problem is that the guys that can't make any money now at $3 with price, what are they doing? They're going to Europe, they're going to Africa, they're going to China to figure out how to drill and exploit shales in other parts of the world. And it's entirely likely that 10 years from now you're going to find that there's gas being produced in places around the world that you didn't know it existed, much less that there is a viable supply source there. So, that's what I mean, is this shale, and it's also on the oil side. The Bakken Shale in North Dakota is turning out to be a world-class oil deposit. That's been existent since I got in the business in 1978. Nobody knew how to develop it. It's been the development of the fracturing and the horizontal drilling and learning how to do it that's made that turn into the play, the outstanding play that it is. My hunch is you're going to find that's not the only shale in the country that's going to turn out to hold a lot of oil when you learn how to get it. But you don't know that. I mean, that's purely conjecture. My point is just there's a lot of uncertainty, and you want to be sure that you're paying attention to this market over the years to come, and have your mechanism in place so you can bail if it doesn't turn out the way you did, or at least you understand what you're getting into.
Okay, we've got a few questions lined up, but Dr. Myers is about ready to jump out of his chair, so I'm going to be real quick.
when we talk about conventional and unconventional, if you look at conventional plays left in the lower 48 onshore, they're very, very deep. They're very small targets typically.
Right.
So those are not typical of the kinds of conventional gas we're talking about in Alaska, very
Absolutely.
Big prospects. So the last tail end, as you've drilled almost all the best ones that you have access to on land, there may be other off-limits area that have good plays. So comparing that to the best coal bed methane, tight gas sands, or shale gas, I would agree. So we don't think we have a disagreement with the lower 48. The Alaska reservoirs are virgin. You haven't tapped them. That's what those slides were about. Those rates on those wells will far exceed, based on the test data we have, the rates out of Prue, the rates out of Point Thompson, will far exceed, by an order of magnitude, the best shale gas wells. And so you've got the sweet spot, the sweet, really good conventional stuff up here versus the tail end. The only exception to that is a deep subsalt, maybe in the Gulf of Mexico and some of these very expensive places where you got to set very expensive platforms. And so we've got to be further offshore. You got to be dealing very deep in multiple layers in the overthrust belt in the Rockies, et cetera, where there still are some of these remaining plays, but they are going to be expensive plays.
Let's take some questions. Good, great discussion. We got Representative Seaton and then Representative Ramirez.
I'll just talk.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess the question was, when you were identifying in these areas where there's the gas prices and there's more gas than can be transported easily, and then you're talking about probability of gas to liquids conversion, and now why wouldn't we be looking at that for here, where if gas price is cheap and we're talking about a 26 to 30 some billion dollar pipeline to get it there, if it's economical to do it down there where you're close to the supply or close to the distribution, wouldn't it make even more sense up here?
So there are various flavors of gas to liquids, and I think you need to start out with an understanding that the Alaska project would go into Alberta at approximately Echo Hub or Boundary Lake, depending on where they connect. It's connecting into a natural gas distribution system that's designed for about 14 BCF per day that's becoming increasingly underutilized. So there's a lot of capacity out, and you see that whole network of pipelines out. There are not very many cases where you believe it's constrained, because the conventional gas decline in the Western Canadian Sedimentary Basin is spectacular. Plays in the shale gas like the Horn River, potential for McKenzie gas, but demand for oil shales, demand for the petrochemical industry, and growth in Canadian uses offset. And so most of the scenarios that people draw show underuse of the capacity in that system. So that was one of the big concerns, and which market does this gas go to? That's why I believe, I won't speak for them, but I believe the producers have designed their system to go into the very liquid hub with a lot of overbuilt capacity because the basin's long past its peak. So there's a lot of different ways out of those basins, and so it's not as constrained as, say, the Rockies have traditionally been, which traditionally an oil basin that very recently became a dominant gas basin, both, again, with the growth of tight gas sands and coal bed methane. So there are some real differences. So we don't see the pinch points and constraints, at least to get to the first liquid hub, that you might out of the Rockies if you build the 4 BCF project. It also speaks to the need, and I'll just put in the pitch in for the expandability. Again, if you find a lot more gas on the slope and you can't get it out, then you're going to stop exploration. You're going to stop development because literally you're backed up behind that single pipeline. That's why the expandability provisions, the easiness of expansion, is the only way you get the exploration activity necessary to build and expand and get more gas out of the market. Otherwise, you're trapped on the slope. With gas to liquids, if it's on the slope, there's two challenges. One challenge is that it's a very clean fuel you produce, a great syndiesel fuel, but you can't really put it down the oil pipeline with oil. You mix it, you contaminate it. So you've got to batch it down, build big storage facilities, and you still have a significant loss of BTU value in conversion. So if the gas isn't stranded, you still have to have a huge structure of facilities. Now, let's say that you do have a point where you get the gas to Fairbanks,
and you think it's constrained, the market's constrained in Alberta, you could have an option when, at a liquid point where there's demand for the fuel to create some gas to liquids opportunities. It certainly is a possibility. But again, the gas is going to flow to the best market that those producers can get it to. So if they don't see the economics with the loss of conversion, they're not going to do it. On the other hand, there may be producers that choose to do it. If you look at Cook Inlet, Cook Inlet had a surplus of gas. And so what did they do? They did three things. One is they increased utilities. Utilities went to generate gas. Secondly, we exported gas through LNG. Thirdly, we built a fertilizer plant. So there are ways to deal with that surplus gas that are market driven. And if Alaska Gas has those issues, gas to liquids could well be one of those solutions that would be employed in Alaska. On the North Slope, though, generally I think the producers believe their highest netback is to get it to that first liquid market. One other point is Alaska Gas, at least out of Prudhoe Bay, is extremely rich in gas liquids, which has a lot of value in the petrochemical industry. So there's a mixture of not only the value of the methane, but the value of the liquids in determining which markets and which processes they use.
Mr. Bennett, any comment on that?
No, other than that, I agree with everything you said. I think it's an excellent plan B. You know, fertilizer, a number of those kind of anything you can do to consume it up here is, to me, a very logical thing to do, at least to be thinking about.
And just so everyone knows, we're 15 minutes beyond our scheduled time. This is an important discussion. I have committee members have to leave. Please leave. In fact, Senator McGuire and I have to leave in a few minutes ourselves. But we have other questions. Representative Ramers.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I like you a lot when you speak, Dr. Myers. And I don't doubt your assertion that our gas is welcome. I just continue to question whether it's commercially viable when it gets there, once you have the capital costs and the tariff costs, and whether it's worthwhile for the state to spend $500 million when ultimately the markets prevail. And I think we all should remember that. My question is for Porter Bennett about the, as briefly as you can, to touch on the fiscal regimes, as we haven't talked about taxes. We've just talked about pipelines and the cost of drilling. And if you could give us just a 90-second overview of some of the dominant taxing mechanisms in these different regions, shale and otherwise, that are driving exploration and development in those areas, please.
I'm not sure I understand the question. You mean incentives, tax incentives that are?
Tax policy, yeah, in some of these dominant areas that we see that are just now opening up.
I'm not aware of any specific, I don't really know, pay much about taxes. I don't know of anything that's an incentive that's for shales particularly. I mean, Texas, I don't believe, has anything like that. Louisiana, I don't believe, has anything unique for shales. I think the flip side is really the more concern. The budget that's been proposed has the elimination of the investment intangible drilling costs, reduction of depletion allowance. Those are things that, if implemented, will have a very retarding effect on drilling activity in the lower 48, at least. It may not affect up here as much because those are majors and they can probably handle it. Most of the gas that's produced in the lower 48 is smaller independents, and tax changes would be very detrimental to their drilling. Because the reason is they're funding their, right now you can't borrow money to drill. There's no capital available for producers. So they're having to fund all their drilling activity out of cash flow. Obviously, take more of their cash flow, they can't drill as many wells.
Thank you.
Very logical.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Meyer, you said that and I think I'm going to quote you here, racing to build pipelines in the lower 48. And so I'm going to, that's your quote, but Mr. Porter, do you think that they're racing to build pipelines in the lower 48 that will speed absorb the kind of volume of gas we bring into Chicago or wherever? Is it really a racing to build?
I don't know how you would, I don't know what he's referring to. I'm not sure what you're referring to.
We were basically talking about the constraints that were there because of the pipelines. He said, my understanding is they're racing to build the pipelines to alleviate those constraints. And I want to.
Well, it'd be kind of hard to characterize most of the activity as a race unless it's snails. You got RECs being built, and that's already done deal. It'll be finished this year. You got Ruby, which is going west, and that is looks like it's going to be built and come online at the end of 2011. There are some that are concerned about the financing of it, but I don't believe that's going to be a problem. They assure us it's not. But you know, but beyond that, there really aren't any major long-haul pipelines being built. Most of there are a lot of them proposed, but you've got to get an open season. You've got to get people to sign up for them. And right now, most of those do not have subscription levels anywhere near enough to bring them online. Yeah, that's in the Rockies. In the Northeast, I had the 45 projects up there. There's a whole lot of pipelines being proposed back there. And some of them are very big projects. Some of them are very small. The big projects are very problematic because there's no sponsor for them. The utilities don't want that much incremental capacity. They're not stepping up. Producers are saying, why should we build the last 5 miles of this? It's not something that makes sense to them. So I think that a lot of those ones into the Northeast are very problematic. There'll be 100 million a day increments here and there that are very quick, easy to do, and that'll help relieve that bottleneck somewhat by 2012, 2015. But building a long-haul pipeline is going to take some fundamental change in demand before you're gonna affect that.
And one follow-up. So the 5 BCF we're going to dump into the Midwest with our pipeline?
Well, if you put it there today without demand, I mean, it just wouldn't work. I mean, you have to, in order for that project to make sense, you have to believe that demand is going to increase by 6, 7, 8 BCF a day. I think if it holds its own, that means that the U.S. has declined, that the lower 48 has declined by 5 BCF, and in 10 years I don't see that happening. In 20 years, maybe. You know, 30 years, much more probable, but in 10 years, I think it's I think that's dubious that you would fit 5 more into the existing demand structure in the lower 48. So,
Dr. Myers, you want to respond?
The big driver is the decline in Canadian production, the Western Canadian Sedimentary Basin. If you look at the energy, our largest gas importer historically has been Canada. There's a dramatic decline. There's also a big push to use increasing natural gas for oil shales. So if you look at depending on the price of oil that you predict, and mm-hmm. if you believe the world's gone back to $45 oil for good, then I think there's a lot of exploration plays out there that won't be developed. Demand will, supply will decrease dramatically worldwide based on what's left to drill in many of the basins in the world that are supplying oil. So there'll be a feedback mechanism and there'll be less oil. So we'll have to be using less oil worldwide. But provided that doesn't happen and oil comes back up, as most folks predict, the $70-$80 range, a lot more gas will be used, consumed in the oil shale unless Canada prohibits its development. So we're looking at not only increased Canadian use, but a significant decline that has occurred and is occurring as increasing in conventional gas in Canada. So the question becomes, do you believe the Horn River shale, coal bed methane, some conventional overthrust plays in British Columbia are going to fill that capacity? Most people don't believe, and you've heard that again from TransCanada, including the McKinsey project. So if you look at demand curves, the traditional demand that's been met from Canada, Alaska gas will help to supplement. The other thing is once it gets to Alberta, it's got a lot of different pipelines you can go through. It's a distributed network. It's a liquid hub. So I'm not saying all that gas will go to Chicago. That gas will flow through the market to the best available market it can reach. But there's a lot of excess pipeline capacity in that system that would then be available for Alaska gas.
I'm just gonna, Senator McGuire, I have to leave for another minute, and I'm going to turn the chair over to Representative Johnson. But I just want to thank both of you for coming in, especially Mr. Bennett, for traveling all the way here. I really appreciate both of your testimony.
And as a follow-up to that, when we were in Anchorage during the pipeline hearings, the administration came forward and said this is going to Chicago. It's not going to Alberta. As a matter of fact, the Alaska Conservation voters testified that they support this pipeline conditionally that it not go. So now are we, because what you've just said, that we're going to be dealing with a lot of it going to the oil sands, are we now going to have opposition from the environmentalists that we didn't have before? Because that was, I don't know if those were there, that's very clearly stated, and I actually talked to them about it. They said as long as it doesn't go to the oil sands, they're all for it.
Representative Johnson, the question is the gas will go to the first liquid hub in Alberta. At that point, it will either go to Chicago or it will offset gas that would go that might have gone there otherwise than went to the oil sands. You're not going to trace the molecule. We're not going to brand molecules of gas, aka gas. It's going to go into the market. The same way you don't brand electrons on an electricity transmission line. Gas will enter the system, gas will leave the system and go to the U.S. market because Alaska gas is available to it. So I don't think it changes the story, but I do not think are in a position to dictate to the producers on the North Slope exactly which market they are forced to deliver their gas. That's not how our system works. And so my expectations would be, unless the country regulates that and requires it to happen through Congress, the gas will go to the Alberta hub, and then it will follow out to the most liquid market.
I would absolutely agree. I don't think that unless there's some different contracting structure than is typical of the market today, it would go to that hub. What I think, I think your theory that the Canadian supply would diminish, that's the way you could get maybe not five, but at least two or three more into the current market size is offsetting Canadian supply. But it's dependent on the Horn River not coming in and the Montney and some of those, and who knows whether that'll happen.
Yeah. Any questions? Representative Senator Wagner?
Well, I was going to say, right now there's about 5 BCF from Alberta going into the United States, so it isn't a matter of where our gas is going to go. You can't trace the molecules, so we're going to have at least 4. You said 5 a while ago. We're only going to put 4 down there because it's going to be 4.3 initially, and it's going to take about 300 MCF a day to actually run the system and everything. So we're talking about 4 BCF. However, we're also talking about liquids in that gas, so it's going to be, as far as when you get it broken out and take those liquids out, you're going to have a big reduction in how many cubic feet of gas you really are, methane you're putting on through to Chicago anyway.
Where do you pull out the liquids?
Well, we're not sure yet. We'd like to pull them off in Alaska.
That's part of
our
discussion.
That may be something that's pretty hard to do. It just depends. Canada wants them real bad right now.
Representative Dugan, you have a question? And we are going to try to wrap up here for a quick.
I do. Thank you. I'm actually not Senator French. And I don't play on television.
Thank goodness. And you didn't stay at a Holiday Inn Express.
No. This is for Mr. Bennett. I've been staring at the third item on your checklist there for some time. State, local, and federal government policy is critical to realizing this fragile opportunity. So can you give me a little bit more on what state, local, and federal government policies are important here?
I thought you wanted to end this quickly.
You could just give me a checklist.
Let's talk about federal first. Okay. We've got an energy policy being formulated right now that more or less ignores natural gas. Let's start there. We ought to be doing a lot more to consume gas as part of all phases of that exercise. But at the same time, it's a little worse than ignoring it. It's actually working against the production of incremental gas through the tax policy we've talked about, through the restrictions or what appear to be growing restrictions of access to lands, particularly. That's really an issue for the Rockies and the offshore. It's not so much an issue for the big shale plays. And then also how we deal with fracking. I mean, those are the federal level issues that can either work for or against. And right now the energy policy seems to be conflicted because on the one hand, they need natural gas to back up what they're doing, even though they don't say it and they don't do much to encourage it. But they're doing these things on the supply side that work against that policy. At the state level, is what this was actually really, the first time I used this was the state of Colorado, because in Colorado, I'm just going to use this as an example, we're very much proponents of wind. And everybody says gas ought to back up wind. Well, that's fine, except for the fact that it's a very expensive way to produce peaking power, And if you used a combined cycle, you'd produce less carbon to begin with as opposed to a single cycle turbine, which you need for wind. And so consequently, state policy in Colorado is reducing demand for gas at the same, well, you know, as part of their energy policy. So that's what I mean. Those are examples of the kinds of things I'm talking about.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative, or Senator Terrio, did you have any questions to send back there? Representative Tuck, I don't want to ignore you. Is there anything else that, any questions anyone else like to have? Gentlemen, thank you so much. It's been very enlightening. It's always interesting to have, and I don't think there was much conflict, so that was very good.
Stay tuned, more to come.
More to come.
More to come.
Thank you so much for traveling.
We could have
changed it. We could have changed it. Thank you so much. Appreciate it. We will adjourn at 5:30. Thank you.
Aye.